Lecture 5, Spies in the Age of Discovery.
Imagine that you have been sent by the French kingdom to spy on the British fleet. The British fleet, after all, is that sign of Britain's power that gives it global reach. And the French are very concerned to find out all that they can about it. The fleet lies at anchor, and you can actually see the ships bobbing up and down off in the distance. You've been charged with finding all that you can about its equipment, its plans, its disposition, its structure. But how do you set about doing this? How can you learn more? What would you do first? Where would you begin? This was the question that faced the famous Italian lover, confidence man, celebrity, and spy, Casanova, in the 1750s. And how he tackled this challenge, we'll consider in this lecture. Several centuries after Europeans encountered what they called the New World from 1492 on, this was an exciting and dangerous time of discovery and competition. European trade, missionary activity, and military expansion, often working all together, reached out to the Americas, out to Asia and Africa, encompassing the globe in a way not previously known and knitting together a world economy. This process of discovery, moreover, was not only geographic. It also involved a mental process, the invention or elaboration of new forms of politics and new ideas. In particular, that set of ideas, that wave of new ideas known as the Enlightenment, which stressed reason, science, utility, rationality. The Enlightenment age would take court intrigue to new heights, now extending worldwide in great empires. And as we've seen before, so it would be now, diplomacy and espionage would be intimately intertwined. The European powers would compete with one another in an intense rivalry to possess what had been revealed. The areas of the globe that Europeans were encountering were so vast that much of that work of exploration was undertaken not by centralized governments, who after all had more limited resources, but by other kinds of people. And here we hearken back to an earlier trend that we saw in a previous lecture, the role of merchants. As in the pre-modern age, merchants lived and thrived on information and intelligence about the lands new to them and where they hoped to make their fortunes. Traders and trappers, especially those French explorers called voyageurs, trekked across the huge expanses of North America, far in advance of any kind of organized European political presence. And so too did another kind of venturesome person, missionaries. In an outgrowth of the religious conflicts of the Reformation, a special role was played by the Catholic Jesuit religious order. We've discussed them in a previous lecture. This order, which had been founded in 1534, had played a very important role in the religious and doctrinal struggles, but here we want to talk about their missionary work. They were especially energetic in venturing out into the world, expanding to India, China, and Japan, Canada, what is today the United States, Brazil, Paraguay, and Mexico. In the Americas, intelligence about what was going on inland was often quite scarce, and the Jesuits might very well have been those who were best informed of all. The Jesuits' gathering of intelligence and experience was not really a form of spying as such, but it was methodical and energetic intelligence gathering towards a religious end, the end of conversion and proselytizing in new lands. There's, in fact, a vast body of literature written about their experiences and the intelligence they gathered. And this is called the Jesuit Relations. The Jesuit Relations are a vast collection of the letters and the reports sent from Jesuits working abroad to their superiors over a span of 200 years, a vast trove of intelligence information. In their missionary efforts, the Jesuits aimed, following the example of St. Paul, to be all things to all men, the better to communicate their religious message. What did that mean in practice? It meant seeking to find or even build points of contact, common ground, between their religious message and the local cultures. which could often be quite foreign to the European context. It meant learning local languages so as to be able to spread the religious message in languages understood in those foreign regions. It meant gaining intelligence on the lands and societies that the Jesuits were encountering and finding ways to accommodate, whenever possible, Christian beliefs to local contexts while remaining true doctrinally to that message. As an example, in China, the Jesuits, as missionaries, cultivated conversations and discourses with the learned Confucian scholars and shared with them their European scientific knowledge, while also, for their part, learning about the vast store of Chinese literature and culture. Incidentally, it was a French Jesuit in China, Jean-Joseph Marie Amyot, who came upon and translated the works of Sun Tzu, the famous Chinese philosopher whom we mentioned in a previous lecture. Before then, his works had been largely unknown in the West. Now they were proliferated. But this kind of intelligence gathering, albeit for religious purposes, could very often lead others to suspect the Jesuits of being spies. A compelling example of this, among many, is that of the German Jesuit Samuel Fritz. Samuel Fritz had been born in Bohemia, what today is the Czech Republic, and had joined the Jesuit order and had been sent to the Amazon region. Fritz had been sent to South America in 1684 and then worked for decades as a missionary in the upper Amazon region. He became famous not only for his missionary work, but also for his exploration of this region and his pioneering work in mapping it. In 1689, as part of his travels, he undertook a canoe journey that ended up in Portuguese territory, and he was imprisoned for 2 years by the Portuguese, who were convinced that he must be a Spanish spy. Consider the irony here. Even the fact that Fritz, the Jesuit, the Portuguese, and the Spanish were all Catholics did not stop suspicions alighting on the Jesuit, did not stop a spy panic arising. Along with the Americas and Asia, more was being learned about a realm that was closer to Europe, but to a very great extent still unfamiliar, and that was Russia, bridging as it did Europe and Asia. In later times, Winston Churchill would call Russia a riddle wrapped in a mystery inside an enigma. And at first, this territory indeed seemed unknown and mysterious. But from around the time of the crises of Elizabethan England that we considered in our last lecture, Russia was starting to move closer to Europe, to become more known. And a new ruler was key in this context, the Tsar, or Emperor, of the Russian state that was growing up around the core of the great city of Moscow. The Tsar that we need to consider as playing a pivotal role was Tsar Ivan IV, known in Russian as Ivan Grozny. Grozny is not entirely translatable. It gets rendered in English as Ivan the Terrible, but it carries also connotations in Russian of Ivan the Awesome, the larger-than-life-size figure. Ivan IV reached out to Europe, sometimes peacefully and sometimes violently. As a peaceful example, in 1553, Ivan and Elizabeth established diplomatic and trade relations, and he mused out loud about he might like someday to marry an English noblewoman. But unfortunately, no one volunteered. More violently, after expanding his realm south and east, Ivan sought to break through to the Baltic Sea to come closer to the established European trade routes. He fought wars in Livonia, in what today is Estonia and Latvia, against Poland and Sweden, but these wars ended badly. They stretched for 24 years, but ended in a disappointment that left him embittered. Internally, and this is the point I'd like to emphasize, he was doing something that was very interesting and also, for our purposes, quite frightening. Ivan the Terrible was constructing a new kind of secret service at the same time within his realm. Let me give you some background about what he might have been thinking. Given that he had come to the throne at the age of 3, Ivan's youth had been marked by a court life that was constantly seized with plotting and violence. And this made him ever afterwards mistrust his own nobility, those who had been plotting and using him as a plaything in their intrigues. Frustrated in his attempts to expand the Russian state by war, and dismayed at what he saw as the disloyalty of nobles within, Ivan threatened to abdicate. until the people of Moscow begged him not to do so. This was a classic case of passive-aggressive behavior. Ivan agreed in 1565, but he placed a condition on that agreement. And that condition was that he be allowed to fundamentally restructure the way the state had been organized and to purge traitors. The result of this initiative was the creation of what was called the Oprichnina. Oprichnina means something set apart, and in this way it actually resembles the word secretary that we mentioned in our first lecture, the notion of a secretary handling things that are secret or set apart. In this case, Oprichnina meant territory that was set apart from the regular or traditional administration, usually by the nobility, and instead was placed under the Tsar's direct, unmediated control so that he could innovate and centralize. Ivan formed a bodyguard of eventually some 6,000 men, the Oprichniki. These men, as the name implied, were men who were set apart from other services. Ivan set them to purge the nobility, whose loyalty he distrusted. And the Oprichniki were feared, as their terror was not something only in the shadows. It was quite open and public. The Oprichniki dressed all in black, rode black horses, and had tied to their saddles the symbol, the vivid symbol, of their organization, which was a broom topped with a cut-off head of a dog. The dog's head was meant to symbolize their sniffing activities as they fanned out across the areas of the Tsar's control and sought out those who were disloyal, while the broom stood for their determination to clean Russia of treason. The Oprichniki worked on the basis of denunciations, and nobody in that society was exempt from suspicion and terror. The Oprichniki became famous for their horrible acts and atrocities. The greatest of these was what happened after the capture of Novgorod in 1570. This was a city that Ivan saw as rebellious and disloyal in the wars that he had been fighting. And he and his followers, the Oprichniki, meted out a terrible punishment. Over 5 weeks, Ivan and his henchmen undertook the mass execution of thousands of people. Some estimates, difficult to believe, run as high as 60,000 inhabitants of the city. The rule of this secret service, the Oprichniki, lasted 7 years, until Ivan became disappointed even with his henchmen and dissolved this regime. Just to make sure that he had wiped the slate clean, he also made sure that his former agents of the security service were killed as well. It henceforward became a capital crime to even talk about the Oprichniki. It's as if they had never existed. Ivan became increasingly unhinged psychologically. He eventually killed his own son and heir to the throne. But he had done something quite decisive. This entire period, known as the Oprichnina, established a tradition within Russia of inner policing and terror. And some, not all, but some later rulers in Russia would follow these precedents. They would leave a very long-standing and durable historical memory as well. The great composer Tchaikovsky, in fact, even wrote an opera called The Oprichnik, first performed in 1874, which featured this episode. It starred a young nobleman who becomes an Oprichnik and then wants to leave that organization but gets dragged back into its clutches. And this precedent also would feature in the activities of a despotic leader, Stalin of the Soviet Union, who would look back on the Oprichnina with admiration. He would criticize Ivan for his religious faith, but would see his centralization and despotism as a model to be followed up on. By this juncture, generally, it was understood that intelligence gathering was an important function of a modernizing state. And when we talk about the great powers of the time, we need especially to mention France. France was the superpower of its time. The main advisor of its king, Louis XIII, was the Cardinal Richelieu, who served as chief minister from 1624 to 1642. Now, the figure of Richelieu has been featured in literature, in the works of Alexandre Dumas, The Three Musketeers, for instance. Richelieu is made to play the sinister role of the arch-villain. But the real Richelieu was actually far more interesting and far more modern in surprising ways in his commitment to efficiency and to the use of power in useful ways for the good of the state. Richelieu set about establishing an elaborate spy network for France. It's also reported, incidentally, that he preferred to hire British spies for this spy network, seeing them as especially professional and good at their jobs. This might have been an oblique sort of homage paid to Walsingham and the traditions that he might have established in England. Following the example of the French, the dominant superpower of its day, other kingdoms also set about establishing such establishments. And pretty soon, many of them had so-called black chambers, which were royal institutions where mail could be examined surreptitiously to keep track of international and internal communications and to chart public opinion and to seek for treason or disloyalty. And yet at the same time, as we see an emerging outline of what starts looking like more modern intelligence bureaucracies, some methods of secret operations could still remain shockingly primitive. Here's one example. In 1654, the northern French city of Arras was besieged, but a messenger got through the lines. Today we would call that messenger a mule, because he was carrying a message that he had swallowed. The message had been placed inside a lead capsule, and he had swallowed it in order to make it safely through the lines without compromising evidence, and he did so. But then a problem arose. Once he arrived safely in the camp of the French commander, who was planning to relieve the besieged city, the secret agent found himself constipated and not able to deliver the capsule over the course of the next 24 hours. Finally, the French military commander simply lost patience, and he roared, "The rascal must have his belly ripped open," at which point the messenger, on hearing this threat, backed out of the tent and was such a fright that the message immediately appeared. Crude and also not very effective. It was at this point that a new philosophy emerged in Europe, which, as opposed to this not very effective example that we mentioned, on the contrary, emphasized above all effectiveness and rationality. This was the Enlightenment. Enlightenment thinkers believed that most, if not all, human problems and social challenges could be met by the application of reason and science. Rationality, not revealed religion or faith or doctrine, should rule, and the result might be human perfectibility, certainly human happiness. The German Enlightenment thinker Immanuel Kant defined this movement of Enlightenment as man's self-emancipation. He used the motto, "Dare to know." The outcome of Enlightenment was to be utility, usefulness, a more rational and effective approach to human affairs. Now, as you might imagine, this mode of thought could be especially appealing to government officials and bureaucrats. That, after all, was their business, effective management. Many bureaucrats subscribed, moreover, to a school of thought called Cameralism, which stressed that good government was a science. It could be methodical, it could be learned, it could be improved upon. Good government, moreover, meant having clear information on what needed to be administered. You needed the data in order to craft effective policies. So the business of collecting that data, this close intelligence, came to be called by the German term, because Cameralism was especially a German science in this day, was called Polizei, which is the same word as is used today for police, but in this case meant something a little bit different. It meant the policing of a society in order to gather information, to keep tabs on everything that was going on for good administration. And thus, the ideal of such administrators who believed in Cameralism was what they called the well-ordered police state. What a terrific irony. Today, we call a police state the epitome of an unfree society, one that's controlled, one that's terrorized. In those days, a police state was held up as an ideal to strive for and one that would ensure greater human happiness. Here, then, is the correlation between the Age of Enlightenment and espionage. Knowledge was essential, and indeed for the Enlightenment, the project of printing encyclopedias that would gather all knowledge was a quintessential project. That urge to know all and observe all would extend to society at large, enemies as well as one's own people. Our own American currency, by the way, on the $1 bill, carries one of the popular symbols of the Enlightenment's urge to know all and see all, the all-seeing eye, an eye with rays atop a pyramid, an apt emblem for the ideal of comprehensive knowledge. One confident Enlightenment figure who played a role in spying was Casanova, who today is remembered not for his writing or his social glamour, but as the very archetype of, what shall we call him, a compulsive womanizer, an erotomaniac, a sex addict. Giovanni Giacomo Casanova was famous in his day as an adventurer and as a social high flyer. He'd been born in Venice in 1725, which at this point was in steep decline from its earlier glory that we discussed in previous lectures. Casanova claimed noble birth, but this seems highly unlikely. His parents were actors, in fact. He studied law in Padua and was admitted for a time into a religious order, but nothing came of this in his case. From 1750, he traveled around Europe to Paris, Lyon, Dresden, Prague, and Vienna, trailing scandal wherever he went because of his numerous love affairs. And not only for his love affairs, but also for his enlightened opinions. Casanova was a confidence man who delighted in selling fake relics, claiming that he had magic healing powers, that he had the ability to turn base metals into gold, and engaging in countless affairs that he would later record in his notorious memoirs. Casanova, in fact, for a while also became famous as an escape artist. He'd been arrested by the authorities in his native Venice and imprisoned in the famous Doge's palace, from which he made a famous escape that made him a celebrity in France, where he escaped too. He was then hired by the French foreign minister to spy on the British fleet during the Seven Years' War of 1756 to 63, which he did successfully. He traveled incognito to Dunkirk, where the British fleet was docked. He'd been warned by his French patron that this was a dangerous task. In words many spies would often hear over the ages, he was told, "We should be obliged to know nothing about you if you were caught." Once in Dunkirk, Casanova worked his social magic. He gained acceptance into polite society and was introduced to British naval officers in social gatherings, who were so charmed by him that they even invited him on board their ships to dine as their guest. And so he gained privileged information at close quarters about the British fleet. He was richly rewarded for this venture. Later, Casanova was not so effective at spying. He tried to engage in industrial espionage while in London in 1763, offering to sell to the Venetian ambassador there a lucrative new trade secret, a process for dyeing cotton cloth a vivid red, but this was refused. His memoirs also do not dwell on another role he played, especially as his career as a libertine began to decline. The spirit was still willing, but the flesh grew weak. This was his role as an informer back home in Venice, whence he returned. Venice, in its decline, had a huge concern for internal security and an extensive internal policing apparatus. It was not actually all that repressive in terms of punishments. It often limited itself to stern warnings or threats of banishment, but its reach was impressive. Casanova earlier had been followed by that inquisitorial system, but now he became an employee of it. And this was out of a need for money. Casanova was hired to move in literate circles, listen to conversations among sophisticated Venetians, and to report back. He reported on the shadowy goings-on of Venetian alleyways at night, gambling in the houses of prostitution, and of lawyers who made critical comments about Venice's government. He reported especially on the dissipation of women in Venice, which was a particular area of expertise for him. Casanova, of all people, was now also reduced to condemning the proliferation of scandalous literature in Venice, including that bearing Enlightenment ideas. In spite of some of his successes, his bosses grew tired of his reports, and it's especially telling that Casanova doesn't seem to have been proud of these activities because he doesn't really talk much about them in his memoirs. We need to consider somebody who was very proud of his spying role, and who has an almost unbelievable story. This is the story of the Chevalier d'Eon, a French master spy who passed as both a man and a woman in an international career of espionage. This super spy of the age was the Chevalier d'Eon. Chevalier means sir, but I'll call him by his French title. To give him his full French name, he was Charles Genevieve Louis Auguste André Timothée d'Eon de Beaumont. He'd been born in 1728 to a family of lesser nobility with a long line of eccentric ancestors. And De Jong became one of the most foremost and well-known transvestites of the period. People speculated on what his true gender was, and indeed there were bets placed on this question and traded in London's mercantile coffee houses. Medical exams were contradictory. One had declared that De Jong was female, but a postmortem in 1810 declared him to be a male, so ambiguity remained. De Jong had been a child prodigy. He had been precocious in learning and music and in athletic pursuits and had become a formidable master swordsman. He studied law in Paris and was noticed at the French court, not least because of his elegant appearance. Contemporaries remembered his long yellow hair, clear blue eyes, his thin figure, and remarkably androgynous appearance. He was recruited into what amounted to the French intelligence service, the so-called King's Secret. King Louis XV of France had a mission for him. He asked De Jong to go on a special mission to Russia, which was approaching Britain diplomatically. And this was worrying to the French because they wanted Russia to be a French ally. He sent De Jong to find out and frustrate this emerging relationship. A Chevalier Douglas, a Scottish emigre, posing as a geologist, was traveling to Russia, and he was to be accompanied by a woman called Leah de Beaumont, who was allegedly his niece, but in fact was the 25-year-old Chevalier de Jong dressed as a woman. What happened next is hard to prove, as de Jong, in fact, himself told different versions of the story. In one, de Jong traveled to Russia, was presented to the Russian Empress Elizabeth, who liked this beautiful young woman immediately and actually made her a maid of honor. When de Jong revealed to the Empress that she or he was a man, in fact, Elizabeth was not angry but thought this was most amusing, and the path was cleared to a French and Russian alliance. De Jong was celebrated in Russia, offered a Russian army command, and given many gifts. But when the Seven Years' War broke out in 1756 between France and Britain, the Chevalier de Jong returned to Western Europe and won fame on the battlefield and was awarded one of the highest decorations in the French army. The Chevalier de Jong was then sent on another mission by the French King Louis XV to England as a temporary ambassador, but at the same time, he also was given a spy mission. He was to scout out in advance details that would be helpful to a French invasion of Britain that was being planned at the time. But then something happened in London. De Jong, perhaps because of high living, perhaps because of anxieties about his social status, seemed to become unhinged. When a permanent ambassador was sent to London to replace De Jong, De Jong refused to step down. And this was an embarrassment for the French court because suddenly there were two people claiming to be French ambassadors in London. But a further and far more dangerous liability was the fact that De Jong had documents from the king about the planned invasion of Britain, and he might be able to use these to blackmail the French government. Finally, after much French anxiety, a bargain was struck with De Jong. De Jong agreed to return these documents so that blackmail could not be executed, and was promised a pension from the French government. But there was a condition attached. Henceforward, he had to promise to dress in women's clothing to make clear that he was a woman. And the logic apparently was that somebody who had been a man but now was a woman would not be trusted by the public if he tried blackmail in the future. De Jong was received back in France with honor as a sensation. Voltaire wanted to meet this person whom he called an amphibian, someone who had been a woman, a man, and now was a woman. And in fact, Queen Marie Antoinette's dressmaker was given the duty of dressing De Jong. Finally, De Jong returned to London and opened a fencing school, and he actually continued fencing in public until the age of 70. Few, if any, careers in the secret world of espionage resemble the incredible and strange trajectory of the Chevalier de Jong. And given how unique a character he or she was, few could. In this lecture, we've seen competitive espionage between great powers as they struggled to dominate a new global reality. We'll look at a different phenomenon, decidedly different: espionage and covert operations inside one society as it was being torn apart at the seams in the American revolutionary struggle that in many cases had the dimensions of a civil war in our next lecture.